Hey, this is Chris.
This is Greg.
We're here joined by our very first advertiser. We have Jason Stapleton.
The Jason Stapleton.
He is a true professional. If you go to jasonstapleton.com and you look at his podcast, it's amazing. Jason, it's a pleasure to have you as a sponsor of the podcast. We encourage all of our listeners to go and listen to your show. Tell us a little bit about what you do over at jasonstapleton.com.
Well, thank you very much for having me, because I paid you.
Yeah.
No, we would have had you on anyway. Yeah. I've been wanting to do this for
Chris
a while.
Chris and I have been talking for a long time. So, I've been a very big fan of your show for a long time, too. And I was telling Chris before the show started, you know, what I really like about your show is I feel like I'm sitting in the living room with you guys, and I feel like it is just a filterless conversation about what's happening in the world from a libertarian perspective, and I think we need more of that. And I just really like your perspective and what you guys bring to the table. So it's a good show.
Do we have to pay you now? Is that how this works?
No, that's you get that one for free.
All right, thanks, buddy. Jason, tell us about the show. What do you do? You broadcast every single day. That must be grueling.
So I do the show 5 days a week, and what we try and do is we try and take what's happening in the news every day and approach it from a libertarian angle. And I try and show how using a libertarian mentality or libertarian approach to the problem will create more wealth, more prosperity, more opportunity for more people than any other possible, structure. And so that's what we try and do every day. And I have a very condensed timeline because I own a couple of other businesses. This is a side business that I'm trying to turn into a primary business. And that's a slow process. But we've been at it for almost a year now. And it's growing. So I'm very happy with the progress, and people who are coming are saying great things about it. And if any of your listeners want to head on over there and check it out, you can download it on iTunes. You can go to YouTube and catch the video version. You can watch it live streaming from our studio if you go to jasonstapleton.com. However you want to do it, it doesn't matter.
I'll tell you what, you have the most impressive video. It is so beautiful. And I professionally, I do video and audio broadcasting and video encoding, and you have the prettiest studio, the prettiest stream. I love the look of your show. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. A lot of people say that it was a very expensive process, but one I wanted to do. I have a belief that a message, you create a lot more message visually when people can see you. And I built several other businesses using video. And I wanted to do the same thing with this podcast, but far more people listen to the audio version than go and watch the video version. But just getting another media form out there and having the space. One of the things I want to do with the studio is have people come in and sit down and do sit down interviews with folks. We've been discussing with at least one of the potential libertarian candidates about having a debate at the studio.
Ooh.
And bringing both of them in to do a head-to-head debate. So a lot of that stuff is stuff we want to use that studio for. But yeah, it's been a work in progress for about a year now.
Well, it is beautiful, and he is being humble, asking you to politely go download the Jason Stapleton Show in iTunes. I, as dear leader, am commanding you.
A fatwa.
This is a commandment from the We Are Libertarians crew to go and download the Jason Stapleton Show. Go to jasonstapleton.com. View the video. There's a lot of different ways to engage with Jason. I think you will, if you're a fan of this show, you will definitely like his show. And, you know, Jason, thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. Okay, I'm going to hit record. And we'll go ahead and get the shenanigans started here. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your fearless, effervescent, triumphant host, Chris Spangle, trying to fit more adjectives. Those are describing words, right?
Sure.
Okay. And across the table from me is Chloe Anagnos, who is either drunk on sangria after drinking four little drinks, or she's just naturally this way, and I've never seen her like this.
No, I'm just naturally this way. You've never seen me like
okay.
this, I promise.
Usually you're uptight and grumpy.
Well, maybe the wine's relaxing me. I don't know.
That's because I'm usually seeing you at work, so.
This is true.
Yeah.
Hi, folks.
And then over on Skype is Roger Paxton. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic, but you don't have any adjectives for me, really?
Beautiful, hairy, sexy.
Okay, I'll take it.
Quasi-intelligent.
Oh.
No, host of the Lava Flow podcast. Where can people get your podcast, by the way? Let's start promoting right out the gate.
TheLavaFlow.com is the best bet. It's on iTunes, Stitcher, and all of the above, but just go to TheLavaFlow.com.
All right, so Chloe is the, I guess you do marketing for the Advocates for Self-Government.
I do. I actually, oh my gosh, I forgot to tell you this. Uh-huh. I am the media director now for the Advocates for Self-Government.
Okay, the Advocates are the quiz people. You may remember I had that position, and then I left to go work for the Bob and Tom Show, and now then Brett Bittner took that position, and he's now been elevated to the executive director. Much against the cries from me to the board, they did it anyways. They don't listen to me. And then they hired Chloe, who is the second best in that job by far.
No,
so it
thanks.
Goes me, and then Chloe, and then Brett. So Chloe, if you order anything from the Advocates, like a World's Smallest Political Quiz or an Operation Politically Homeless Kit, Chloe is the one that is sending it to you. So.
Yes.
And then, Roger, do you have any official titles with the Libertarian Party anymore?
Thank God I do not.
you sat on the judicial committee of the National Libertarian Party for a while. You were the chairman of the Arkansas Libertarian Party.
Yeah, I was the chairman. I was the first district rep for a while. I was the secretary for a while. I've pretty much worn all the hats, but I am free and clear for a little while.
So we'll talk about that in a second, but you may notice I did not begin the show with our standard greeting, which is, joining me as always is one Greg Lenz. For the second time in 2 weeks, Greg has not shown up for a podcast.
Greg could not handle the awesomeness of me and Chloe. That's just all there is to it.
Well, Chloe was supposed to be on last week's episode, but she no call, no show, didn't you, Chloe?
I'm sorry. I was moving.
The insult that was cast upon Dear Leader by young Chloe was it was much too much. She had to bring an offering tonight to get back in my good graces. So she brought an apple pie, and then I gave her wine, which is, I provide all young co-eds, and when all young female co-eds, when they enter, here's some sangria and a bendy straw.
It's a pink bendy straw to make it even better.
I know. Wow. She is literally sitting across from me at the table drinking sangria out of a little cup, a little glass, with a pink bendy straw.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So Greg had a flat tire, I say in air quotes, 2 episodes ago when Rob Kendall was here. And had to fix that. He did send photographic evidence. I don't know if he or Tyler photoshopped that. And then tonight, he allegedly has become a minister. I don't know how this happened, but he's marrying people now. And he is ordained or fake ordained through the internet to marry people. And the parents that apparently they might have seen his Hitler memes on my Facebook page, because they thought, oh, gee, there's something fishy here. Maybe we ought to interview this guy a little bit about his morals and what his credentials are. So he's getting grilled right now at a restaurant. So he may or may not join us. I'm not sure. But either way, he did show prep, which I am in the process of reading as I open the show. So we may have some information for you. I don't know.
You're doing better than I am. I couldn't read it all.
Well, you read some. That's all there is. Did you guys watch the Democratic debate?
I watched the first hour of it, and then I went to bed.
I didn't watch not 1 minute of it.
Yeah, me neither. I you know. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about a few other things as soon as I scan through the notes. But I want to talk to Roger. Roger, you are a highly successful, a gorgeous father of how many kids?
Two boys.
Oh, your poor wife. So, 3 men in the house. She must get fart raped all the time.
Well, at least one of the dogs is a female. So
okay.
But the dog farts as much as I do.
So, Greg today posts on his Facebook this meme that I pray to Allah that this is a joke. Let's see here. I just reposted it. Fart rape. Ashley Engel, CUPE, leader and teacher up at the University of somewhere in Michigan, I think it is, By farting louder, the man is using passive-aggressive violence to position himself as a dominant. This intimidates the woman to subconsciously not release as much flatulence, and thus the woman, fearing for her safety, doesn't fart as loud as a sign of submissiveness. This, in turn, contributes to rape culture and women being oppressed. And then there is a tweet, which does not exist, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't have been deleted at some point. Warning from Ashley Ingle: fart rape just occurred on the train to Oakville line. Rapist. And then they showed the picture of him. Now, Chloe, I farted just moments ago. Do you feel like you are submissive to me now?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. It's the wine, though. It's the wine. Okay. If
at least, at least he didn't lock you in his closet yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. Not in it yet.
So I'm just saying, if this exists, you make a mockery of rape. If it doesn't exist, it is great satire. Honestly. Chloe, do you ever fart on Pedro, your boyfriend? Do you show him who's boss?
Maybe I have a few times. Maybe I haven't. I can't really answer that. But Pedro, I think, likes it. I really don't know.
Okay. Pedro's a freak, man. Oh, Roger, fart rape, your opinions.
Well, I mean, just based on what I've seen, it does look like this A. Ashley Ingle or whatever her name is. I mean, she's serious about this. So yeah. I think you're absolutely right. It makes a mockery of everything.
Yeah. Now, you just announced, you have a big announcement on your podcast, The Lava Flow. You are taking your two boys and your wife and your female dog, and you guys are moving out of Arkansas, in which you have lived your entire lives. For what are you doing this? Is that the Queen's English?
That is not.
Chloe's a grammar Nazi. I'm trying.
Well, we are moving to New Hampshire to join the Free State Project.
Oh, cool. Wow. Okay. Explain what the Free State Project is for those noobs.
The Free State Project is a project that began in 2003 or so, where they're trying to get 20,000 libertarian activists to move to one geographic area to effect positive change to bring about liberty in our lifetime. And so they looked at several different states. They looked at Arizona, Nevada, I think Wyoming, and New Hampshire. And New Hampshire just came out on top. So they selected New Hampshire, you know, sometime around 2004, 2005. And they've now been trying to get 20,000 people to sign the pledge to move up there. Right now, they're at almost 18,000 people signing the pledge. And they're growing by about 1% a month. So they will sometime late next year have 20,000 signers if they continue at this rate.
Nice. Now, all those people that sign, they intend to move there, but they're not moving at this exact moment. I mean, is there like a time limit? Do you have to move?
Well, the pledge states that you intend to move and affect positive change within 5 years of them reaching 20,000 signatures.
Okay.
So you don't have to move, obviously you're not going to be required to anyway, but you have signed a pledge to move, but you don't. The pledge doesn't really take effect until it hits that 20,000. However, there are lots of libertarians who, you know, are sick of where they live. They're sick of fighting for liberty and not getting anywhere like we are in Arkansas, and they're moving early. They're called early movers. And right now there's a little over 1,800 early moving libertarians that already live in New Hampshire.
Nice. Okay, so, yeah, it would be kind of ironic if the Free State Project forced all the people that signed the pledge to move there.
Right.
I mean, is it realistic to think that, is it one of those things that you think people sign up for it and then they don't ever intend to move, like if push comes to shove? I mean, that to me, I would sign up, but then when, I don't know if I move.
Well, most libertarians you would think are moral people who would seriously consider something like that before signing a pledge. However, you're right. I mean, there's no chance that they'll get 20,000 movers in that 5 years. However, if they get half of that, you're talking 10,000 libertarian activists in a small geographic area that only has about 750,000 voters.
Right.
I mean, the Free State Project, even with only 1,800 people there, have already elected about 24 state representatives to the state house in New Hampshire. And that's way before the pledge has been signed, met their 20,000 signatures.
So why did you decide to do it? Why are you moving now?
Well, a few months ago, I was in a position that I'd been in for several years. I didn't feel like I was growing with that position, so I started looking elsewhere. I looked at some positions here in, you know, where I live. I looked in Austin, Texas. I even looked in at one in St. Croix, Virgin Islands, and I applied for some in New Hampshire. And, you know, I actually took another position here in Memphis about 2.5 months ago, and then I got a call back from one of the positions in New Hampshire that I had been working back and forth with, and I just assumed I didn't get it. And he flew my wife and I up there, I guess 3 weekends ago, and offered us a position the next day.
Nice. Congratulations. So it wasn't like you're packing up and moving to New Hampshire and you'll find a job once you get there. You got your job there, and
My kids have to eat.
Your family should come first.
I've definitely got to keep a job, and I mean, it's a really good position. It's a director of IT position for a healthcare conglomerate, and I've been in healthcare for the last 5 years, so it's a perfect fit for me. The salary is excellent. I mean, it's a great position, and not to mention the other benefits for my family outside of my job. So it's, you know, it didn't take us much to figure out we were definitely going to do this.
Yeah, that's great. So have you made contact with anybody who lives there at this point?
We have. Actually, you know, I've got several friends up there as it is. Daryl W. Perry, who's running for a Libertarian Party nomination for president, he was on my podcast a few, 3 or 4 months ago. And there's others, but while we were up there, the specific area that we're going to move to is called it's the Seacoast, but they call it the Free Coast. And it's right outside of the Portsmouth area, Somersworth, Dover, that whole kind of area. So while we were there, we met a couple of people there for lunch on Sunday before we flew home, and had some great times, and just, you know, hearing all of the stuff that's going on out there. It's just, it's fantastic.
I always hear a lot about Keene, New Hampshire. Is that in that area?
Keene's about an hour and a half away. It's more southwest of the Portsmouth area.
I think that's go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, the great thing about New Hampshire is that everything is within, you know, an hour to 2 hours of everything. I mean, it's such a small, compact state, whereas most states, you know, if you try to get a Liberty event together, everybody's so spread out. It's definitely not that way in New Hampshire.
So why did you, or my former intern, Lauren Rumpler, Lauren is Objectivist Girl.
Yeah, I didn't know you knew her.
Yeah, I think she was my intern at the Libertarian Party of Indiana, I think back in 2012. Hmm. It was 2012, and then she, I think, lives in Keene now, and obviously the Free Talk Live guys are out in New Hampshire, correct?
Yep.
They're in the Keene area.
Yeah, Ian and Mark.
Yeah, there's a ton of great libertarian broadcasting that comes out of there. If you've never been to LRN.FM, go check that out.
Yeah, definitely. Free Talk Live is a great. I listen to it every single day when I'm at work. But they also, I mean, Daryl Perry has a podcast. There's, you know, several different media podcasts specifically coming out of Keene, but there's even more coming out of the rest of the state as well. And Keene is one of those kind of activist centers where, you know, there's a lot of libertarians in that small town of 30,000 people, but there's other cities like that as well. There's a lot in Portsmouth. There's a lot in Concord and Manchester. And then, you know, they have three big events every year where everybody just kind of comes together, and I just can't wait to get up there.
Yeah, Porkfest is something that Harry is always trying to get us to go to. I think he just wants us to go to the nude part. So I don't know why Harry's trying to see me naked, but
there used to be the big gay the Buzz's big gay dance party every year, but I think last year was the last year they were going to have that, unfortunately.
What?
Yeah, Buzz is retiring apparently.
Well, can't they find another gay to have a big dance party?
Well, like, I guess, like, I don't know. I mean, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
Or you could just go and
you
do
it. All right. See, we tried to make each other gay right at the exact same time. That's how I guess how it works, though. Well, that is exciting news, mostly because you'll have more money, and very few libertarians have any money, so I'm glad to hear that. And that'll be good for your family and also other libertarian causes.
Well, and there's a lot of libertarian causes up there. As a matter of fact, one thing that Jess and I have already plugged, Jess is my wife, mm-hmm. That we've already plugged into is they've been doing this for several years, but this year they're trying to feed 500 families Thanksgiving dinner. And it's a charity they've been doing there for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now. And every year it grows and grows. So they're having this big party mid-November where they're bringing everybody together for several hours to package all the meals together and take them to the to these needy families. There's just so many opportunities like that for activism and things to do that most states just don't have.
That's great. Yeah, and that to me is exactly what libertarians ought to be doing is you know, half the time doing political work, half the time doing charity work.
Right,
you know, where you are making it clear that you're doing this because you're libertarians, or you know that it's helping people as part of your value system.
Yeah. And the guy who thankfully you know took over at the Advocates, Brett, you're better. he really harps on that quite a bit. The you know the charity work as well, and you know I think that is absolutely important because it's you know as he says it's really important to walk the walk and talk the talk. And I mean, it's something that we all need to do more of.
Well, let's be honest. Every idea Brett has ever had, he has stolen from me.
Oh, okay.
But to his credit, he usually makes them better. So we always joke because I started the LP 101 classes here in Indiana, and then he stole the idea and he made them better. But so the Lava Flow podcast, how has growth been? Tell us what you do on the podcast. How has it evolved? How many episodes in are you now?
Well, I'm 22 episodes in. I started on January 3rd, and I only do one episode every 2 weeks just because, frankly, I have a lot of demands on my time. I've got a sure. high-stress job, a high-stress wife, high-stress kids, and you know, so I knew that I wouldn't be able to do a whole lot of it. So once every 2 weeks, and that's about half an hour every episode. So I'm at 22 episodes now. And, I mean, growth has been just incredible. I mean, every month over month, I've got this graph that I posted a few weeks ago on my Facebook. It's just every month over month, it's bigger and bigger. And, you know, I don't do any advertising for it other than posting on Facebook. So
right.
you know, to see people picking it up like that, it's just, I love it. It's fantastic.
You were actually, your move to New Hampshire was the first story in Rational, I can't think of the exact name. I'll have to look it up because it's such a great email that I love getting every day, but it's the Rational Review, I believe it is.
Is that Tom Knapp?
Yeah, Tom yeah. Knapp's thing.
Yeah. Tom and I are good friends. We've known each other for, a decade now. He's a great guy.
Yeah, so it's Rational Review News Digest, and then yeah. it's rationalreview.news-digest.com/today's edition. But I'm sure if you... We'll put it up on the Facebook page. I'll put it up on October 16th, 2015 for our future listeners. Sign up, and they send out an awesome email every day with a ton of commentary and news. It's really like the only email newsletter that you need to get.
Yeah, it's kind of an aggregate of so many different libertarian sources and a lot of you know Tom's own stuff as well. It's a great resource.
Yeah, and you were actually the lead. I opened it up, and I thought, gee... The Lava Flow podcast is the number one story in Rational Review. How much did he pay for that? He can't be getting that much traction already.
I didn't pay a penny for it. Tom's just somebody I've known for a long time, and you know I share some of his stuff. He's put my podcast on that digest a couple of times, so you know.
That's great.
So, I'm just a nice guy.
I know. You're a sweetheart.
Right.
And it's your southern charm.
Not to be southern much longer.
Yeah, Chloe has southern charm.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes. It's all fake, but...
Well, no. A lot of my family lives in Texas, Alabama. I've spent a lot of time there as a kid.
She's a pageant girl, so that... Oh, is that,
please.
She's like Miss America over here.
Yeah, I try.
So, your podcast, like... And I don't know if listeners get interested in this kind of stuff. We talked a lot of process with Jason Stapleton, but I love kind of... I love the story and how people I love the process of starting these kinds of things. I mean, we talk a lot about the change in the We Are Libertarians universe over the last 3.5 years and the various stages. And I always think it's interesting. I love when people create and put things out into the world, and you know, it can be a little nerve-wracking to start your own podcast and say, "Hey, I'm an authority. Listen to me. This is why I should build an audience." But I love when people do it and just sort of have that courage to put it out there. So over the last 22 episodes, over the last, 10 months that you've been doing this, I mean, what are some of the big takeaways what have you learned? Have you grown? And then we'll talk a little bit about the show. Like you personally, just creating something and putting it out into the world, how's it helped or changed you?
Well, you know, the reason I started the show was because I wanted to learn more, and I was either too lazy or, you know, not dedicated enough to take the time to sit down and learn more. You know, I'd read books about libertarianism here and there, but, you know, not like I really needed to. So I did the show to kind of force myself to delve into these topics and these things that I wanted to learn more about. at least once every episode, I pick a topic that I don't know as much about that I want to know more about. So I pick those topics, I get books, I search the internet, and I spend a lot of hours writing this stuff. I mean, you know, it's a half-hour podcast, but I probably put in, you know, 10 to 15 hours per episode on writing and recording and producing and doing all of that. So there's a lot of work behind the scenes, and to me, that's made me a more knowledgeable libertarian. And in the process, I'm able to share that journey with everybody else and share that knowledge with everybody else. And, you know, that just makes me feel... It makes me feel good that I'm able to, number one, learn more, but also share that with everybody else.
And Chloe, if you have questions for Roger, we're not doing a formal interview, but
sure.
If you have questions, please feel free to jump in. I don't, I will, and I normally do monopolize most of the time here.
Well, that's because you're Chris Spangle.
But I paid for this damn microphone. So so that's cool. Like, how have you seen what has changed in the program over the last 10 months?
Well, it's definitely gotten better. I've gotten much better at editing. You know, when I first started this, I had zero audio editing background at all. So I have learned a lot there. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, so I pick up some ideas there on how to do things a little bit better. And I listen to a lot of podcasts about podcasting, so I pick up a lot of information from them, learning how to produce the podcast better. So the basic format of it hasn't changed much. You know, I do an opening segment called What's Wrestling My Jimmies, and, you know, talk about that one topic that's really pissing me off that week or whatever. Then I do a short news segment with, you know, anywhere from 3 to 7 or 8 sometimes news topics, and kind of give a libertarian spin on those news topics. And then I've got a bunch of other topics that I do, a bunch of other segments, some of them, you know, about police brutality, some things about, and I have one called My Roads, where I talk about things that, you know, that supposedly only the government can do better, but they've screwed up. I do one about, you know, stupid things politicians say, and just a lot of different, you know, segments that I kind of just rotate in and out.
Okay. And you've started doing interviews. Why decide to add interviews to it?
Well, I do interviews every once in a while. I've done 3 interviews out of 22 episodes, and it's usually when I find something interesting. Like I interviewed Daryl Perry because he was running for president as a libertarian, and my philosophy and his philosophy match up quite a bit, so I wanted to introduce him to my listeners. I also interviewed Nick Sarwark, the LNC chairman, and, you know, just because I wanted to present the Libertarian Party side of things a little bit, because I have a lot of anarchists that listen to the show, and, you know, I firmly believe that even as an anarchist, and I am one, that you should still be involved at least somewhat in electoral politics, if for nothing else than to vote in self-defense.
Right.
And I also interviewed, of course, you know, our friend Brett Bittner, who I've, you know, known for many years as well, and I interviewed him primarily
No, just kidding.
That's Chloe booing both of them.
Well, I primarily interviewed him because he forced me to, because I interviewed Nick, and if I interviewed Nick, I had to interview Brett.
But like, you know,
it was right after Brett took his position with the Advocates, and, you know, Advocates is something that I fully believe in, so I wanted to get that out there as well.
Well, thank you.
So, Chloe, any other final comments on the Lava Flow podcast? I'm sure you'll wedge them in later, but...
Well, sure. The one, I had to get up to go to the bathroom for a second, excuse me, so if you already answered this question, then that's my fault. But
she fart-raped my bathroom.
Yeah, I did. Wow.
That's gross.
Aggressively. but so you mentioned that some of your listeners are anarchists. You've got about 22 episodes now. So how do you gauge some of your listeners? How do you get feedback from them if you even need it?
You know, it's amazing how much interaction I have with my listeners. And I think that it's because, you know, I ask my listeners questions. I ask them to, you know, to let me know what they want to hear and to, you know, contact me about certain things. So I hear from a lot of my listeners quite often, and I love that. I love that interaction with my listeners because it keeps me on point. I've actually had listeners point out where I've been wrong before, and I love that. So, you know, I interact with them. Which is fantastic. And, you know, I did mention that there are anarchists, and LAVA actually stands for libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist, and agorist. It's so I try to produce the show for all of those groups, obviously libertarian being the kind of group that covers all the rest. But, you know, I don't want it to be just for partisan libertarian politics. I also want it to fill those other areas as well.
Awesome. Very cool.
So, Chloe, you've been working for the Advocates for how long now?
About 4 months.
Four months.
Mm-hmm, going on five.
So, you're a Republican, correct? Scumbag Republican?
No, I wouldn't say I'm a scumbag Republican. I would say I am a... I'm trying to think. If it helps at all, on the world's smallest political quiz, I'm an 8,100 libertarian.
So 100 economic, 80 personal.
Personal, group? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which ones are you? Which ones are you lax on? Which ones are you deficient?
You know,
in your purity.
I can't name them off the top of my head. I think the one personal one that I hit maybe on was ending the drug war. I do have a cousin that's a heroin addict, mm-hmm. so that's something that when I answer that question, it's like I have to keep that kind of in the back of my mind.
Right.
But so, can I ask a question, Chloe?
Sure.
Would it make your cousin less of a heroin addict if the police were banging down his door and carting him off to jail or even possibly shooting him? Because every law is backed up with the violence of a gun. I mean,
right.
It just, yeah, you know, he's a heroin addict, and, you know, that's terribly sad. That sucks. I mean, I hate drugs personally,
mm-hmm.
but the last thing he needs is the police presence to be involved. He needs more of medical help.
Right. And I agree with that. It's just something that's hard for me, at least it's my cousin, it's a she, unfortunately. Oh, no, you're fine. You wouldn't know that if I wouldn't have said anything. But it's just one of those things where I see how drugs just, you know, tear up a family. And at the same time, I think the drug wars and drugs themselves are just something that's very, it's a very complex issue. It's very difficult to deal with. So that's kind of why I hit maybe, just because it was one of those things where had she not have gone to prison for a year, 2 years, I don't think she would have been able to get clean. And granted, she's in a different state. She's in Illinois. I don't necessarily know what, you know, their system's about, but I think they're a little bit better, at least in her part of the state, when it comes to, you know, partial, I think it's like a partial prison, partial like rehab program, something like that. Just because, you know, with a lot of, you know, drug use comes a lot of crime at the same time. So that's, you know.
Well, but part of that reason is because drugs are illegal. And the reason that there's
absolutely
a lot of crime associated with drugs is because they're hard to get. They're on the black market. They're extremely expensive because of that. If they were much cheaper, that whole level of crime that's surrounded around drugs would severely diminish. Now, of course, it wouldn't go away for, you know, completely, because people still, you know, will rob a convenience store for a Snickers or whatever.
Right, but, right, absolutely.
But it would still be a lot less. And I think that's part of the issue that we have in this country, is that we've made it profitable for people to rob and steal to stay high. And if we remove those barriers, yeah, they would still, you know, probably get high, but then now they wouldn't be dealing with police issues and robbing and stealing and
right.
possibly getting shot because they're trying to rob somebody.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any shame in beginning your work in the libertarian world. I mean, when I started in 2008 for the Libertarian Party of Indiana, I was very, very, I wouldn't say anti-gun. I certainly was not Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders by any stretch of the imagination, but I definitely didn't see the reason why you needed an automatic weapon or a tank or a nuclear weapon. And now my answer is, well, if they've got a nuclear weapon, I want one too. you know, now
I gotta take you shooting sometime.
Right. I've never shot a gun in my life.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Mm-mm, no. I'm the worst libertarian ever.
Wow.
I've never shot a gun. I've never smoked weed. I've never drank.
Yeah, we're taking you to a guns and weed party for sure.
Oh, yes. But I think everybody sort of starts down the libertarian path and they go, this is my thing. I don't know. I don't quite. I don't want to say soft on this, but I was thinking the other day about where I was at. I was actually digging around down there in all these papers, and I found my notebook from 2009 when I was sort of putting together thoughts for the things that I would do. And like I had this little notebook, and I made this list of all the ways that I wanted to change the Libertarian Party of Indiana during my time there. By the time I left in 2012, I reviewed that, and I had done every single one of them. Not right away, but over the course of, you know, never having reviewed that list again, it was like, it was fascinating to see, like, okay, put these goals down. This is what I think we ought to do. And we ended up achieving that. So, but
I did the same thing as the chair of Arkansas. When I started, I wrote out just a personal 4-year roadmap because I wanted, you know, this was something I didn't share with anybody else. I just kept it to myself, but it's where I wanted to see the party go. And I more than exceeded, you know, what I had hoped for. And it wasn't just me. I mean, it was because there were lots of people that were helping. But, you know, we took it far beyond even what I thought that we could.
Yeah, us too. But on the front cover of this Moleskine notebook is, and if Greg were here, he'd make fun of the fact that it was a Moleskine. But it has a Glenn Beck Constitution Watchdog sticker on the front of it because I was really into the Constitution at that point. And I just remember seeing that the other day and kind of chuckling and saying, oh, how far I have come from 2009.
Yeah.
You know, which is not that long ago. That's only, you know, 6 years, 7 years ago.
And I've come a long way too. I started off as I was still not really there for open borders, and there were a couple of issues where I still was not quite there. So, you know, I think everybody kind of makes that transition for sure.
I was out on, I guess it was a date. We could call it that. I don't know what I'm doing. Well, we could get into my personal life some other time, but we only have like an hour left. But. She's like, so well, how much government do you think there should be? And I said, well, would it weird you out if I said I don't think there should be any? I don't even know if that's the right answer, but I definitely don't think, you know, we talked a little bit about a minarchist state with, you know, private police and how versus, you know, private courts and all that stuff, which is always where I get stuck. It's the private court stuff. But
well, then you should listen to The Lava Flow. Actually, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes ago or maybe longer, I did a two-episode segment about private police and private courts. You should definitely go check that out.
I will go check it out, but I have had Walter Block explain for private courts to myself and Greg. Greg and I, he didn't convince me. So good luck, well, Roger.
I would never say that I could convince you more than Walter Block for sure. So I'll step out of that.
Yeah, but and that's one of the cool things about doing this podcast is like you get to say arrogant things like, "Yeah, Walter Block was explaining to me private courts, and he convinced me." I've had my mind changed about IP by Jeffrey Tucker. You know, like you get to you know we're a bunch of I don't want to say nobodies, but we're a bunch of people who love libertarianism and just said, hey, let's start our own blog and our own podcast and ask these people on. And then all of a sudden, like, they said yes, and we get to talk to Noam Chomsky or Ron Paul. Like, it's all pretty cool. So,
or Tom Woods. That was Tom one Woods. Of my favorite episodes of yours.
Yeah, and like that, it's just amazing. And, you know, gosh, I can't think. I'll look at it. Mark Thornton. Mark Thornton's episode during my lost weekend after my divorce, when Joe and Greg kind of handled the podcast for a few months, the Mark Thornton episode is one of the best hour-long descriptions of what libertarianism is I've ever heard in my life. Like, you know, so it is great to get to go back and talk to these people. But we're talking about, what are we talking about, Chloe? What were we talking about? Private courts, minarchism.
Oh, no government?
No government.
How that would work?
So we all kind of come into the libertarian movement with a few things that, like, some remnants of statism. So we will beat the drug war out of you soon enough. You know what you need to go watch? Mandatory. I will make sure that you watch this. Have
from
you
your closet.
Yes, because you're not leaving here tonight. The House I Live In on Netflix.
No, I've not. I'll have to watch that.
It is my favorite documentary. It will change your view on drugs, propaganda, and the media. How we handle the class system in this country.
Sure.
Amazing documentary. So go check it out. The parallels between Nazi Germany and the Jews versus drug addicts and our politicians and the media and how we handle, you know, people that commit crimes in this country, especially drug users, it's frightening. So definitely something to check out.
Sure.
What, like, when you started, Roger, like getting involved in libertarianism, like what were the things that were kind of like, where would you be marking maybe on the world's smallest political quiz? Mine was guns, hers was drugs. Like, what are some of the big issues that you were kind of like, you know, I know for Greg, his was and might still be interventionism. you know, and how do you handle ISIS? And, you know, he when he started on the podcast, much to the chagrin of some of our listeners, including you, like, you know, he's a little yeah. militaristic. And then you have heard him kind of soften over the course of the podcast.
Well, since I started listening to We Are Libertarians, Greg has certainly made a huge shift in his thoughts on policies for interventionism. Now, of course, he's still big on that, you know, looking at what's going on around there, which is great. We need to know what's going on in the Middle East and the rest of the world. I really appreciate his perspective on that. But his perspective, like you said, has certainly softened. Now, as far as the issues that I had with on the political quiz, my big one was the open borders. That really, you know, that took me a long time to get over, primarily because, you know, I was under the impression that these illegals were coming over here and killing everybody and stealing jobs and, you know, they were taking our welfare and all this stuff. And, you know, then you actually start looking at the truth behind that and you realize that none of that's really the case. And, you know, when you start studying economics, which for some reason libertarians seem to do that after a while, you learn that open borders is critical for economic infrastructure. So that one took a little while to get over. That was probably my biggest one.
So kind of delve into the open borders. I certainly it's not even like a I certainly when I started was not an open borders guy. I now at this point I kind of don't care, and I do see the general absurdity of drawing imaginary lines on the planet and saying, nope, this is my territory, you stay out. When really you want freedom to move, because with the freedom to move comes, you know, more economic growth and a better distribution of skills and spontaneous order. What are some of the other reasons that you support open borders? Because that's clearly an issue with L. Donald in the news.
Well, if you build a wall, I mean, walls have historically kept people out, but they've also historically kept people in. I mean, look at the Berlin Wall, for example. You know, if we're going to build a wall around this country, we need to be aware that that wall is, it goes both ways. So that's certainly something to be concerned about, and Trump is big on building the walls. But, you know, Trump is such a hypocrite because he has hired so many illegals in his career that it's not even funny. And yet here he is bashing on the immigrants and the illegals. I don't understand his position on that. But economically, you know, you need to have that cheap labor base to for your economy to function and thrive. And if we don't have, because Americans aren't going to do that kind of work. Americans are going to get, you know, sit fat and happy on welfare before they go dig a ditch.
Right.
So we need that base of that hardworking immigrant worker that we've had in this country since the inception of this country. We've always had that base of, you know, low skilled immigrant worker come in and do those jobs that other people don't want. And we're losing that. And we need that back.
What were some of the hurdles that you faced in getting to this position? I mean, mentally, you know, when you work out an issue like this, you kind of go through stages, it feels like. It's almost like you start at one point, which is sort of the more statist position, and then you end up more at the libertarian anarchist position on an issue like this. And then there are these roadblocks that you kind of have to work through. I mean, what are some of the stumbling blocks that you found?
Well, you know, you mentioned statist. I really did start off very statist on this position. I was keep them all out all the time. We don't need them. We don't want them.
Arkansas. And I had something in my throat. Arkansas.
Right. So then, you know, I got to looking at it and I thought, well, as long as they're coming over here, you know, legally and they're not, you know, using all welfare and things, okay, then I'm okay with immigration a little bit. And, you know, and then I got to looking at how many people actually were coming over here and getting on our welfare, and it's very low. And so then that kind of shifted me a little bit more to the open borders position. And then when I started studying economics, that's what really did it for me. You know, and if we're really truly free people, if we can really truly say that we're free, then we should be able to say that we're free to go wherever the hell we want to and wherever the hell we're invited. If I want to invite my friend Jose from Guatemala to come to my house, by God, if he's a free man, he should be able to come to my fucking house. Sorry.
It's okay. I have cable.
Yeah, we allow cursing on our podcast.
Right, I forgot about that.
Yeah, say whatever.
I actually got chewed out on one of my iTunes reviews recently. It said, why the profanity? An otherwise great podcast is being held down by the unprofessional profanity and dropping of F-bombs. Like, shit.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chloe said, yeah. Uh-oh, the sangria is kicking in. There's always things like that that are used to scare that, like, make sense, but they're not actually backed up by actual evidence. Like the, you know, the, well, we can't have welfare and open borders at the same time, but, so you're saying, like, that the number's very low if you actually do your research and you take a look at that statistic.
Right, it's scaremongering, nothing more. I mean, are there people that come over here and use some of our public resources? Absolutely. But is it a percentage that makes a difference? No, it's a very, very minute percentage. And the same with the ones that come over here and commit crimes. I mean, most people who come over here are coming over here to bust their ass, make some money, and send that money back to their families back home.
So, Chloe, as you've lived inside the libertarian world for the last 4 months, for the first time you worked for the Republican Party in a very Republican county here. You mm-hmm. And then you were in college,
right?
And you were in student government. You were on with Brett a few episodes ago, and we talked a little bit about that. And it was like your first month, so it's been 3 months. Holy cow!
Oh yeah.
What are some of the things that you've kind of learned about the libertarian movement as you you're new to it? So what have sure. you seen as you lived in the belly of the beast?
I think one of the biggest things that I wasn't really expecting was that I would be really like challenged in a lot of my views, which I think is a good thing, mm-hmm. Because I'm from originally Elkhart, Indiana, which is a very small community. Worked for a very Republican organization, doing mainly PR for my internship in college, was on a pretty, I would say Ball State's a pretty moderate campus here in Muncie, Indiana. So I really hadn't gotten super, super out of my comfort zone, or especially like in my worldviews about some things. So Brett and I have just kind of sat at the end of the day for the past few months and just talked about anything and everything, especially when it comes to liberty, crime in America, and then I'll lay this on you because this like blew my mind when he and I were talking about it. So are you guys familiar with the show To Catch a Predator?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we were talking about it, and I think this was mainly because we get a lot of mail.
For anybody not familiar, right. To Catch a Predator was Chris Hansen, and Chris Hansen would go out and catch child molesters in the act trying to set up a date with like a 13-year-old girl or whatever.
Right, absolutely. So we get a lot of mail from all over, but we especially get a lot of mail from incarcerated people. So we were talking about the prison system and some of the crimes that maybe some of these people had committed. And Brett posed the question. He said, so on the show To Catch a Predator, what crime was actually committed? Because if you think about it, these people that are getting arrested on this television show weren't necessarily talking to a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old trying to set up a date. They were actually talking to an of-age police officer that was undercover. So he kind of posed that question to me, and I just remember they're sitting at my desk like, whoa, this is crazy. They thought they were talking to someone that was, you know, underage, but there was no crime that was committed because no act was actually done.
Right.
So and of course we were talking about that, and I don't think anyone has ever been able to, you know, get out of a prison sentence with that defense. There might have been a few exceptions, because I think Brett had mentioned that, but it was just interesting. So then he posed the question, is it illegal to think? Because if you're thinking that you were, you know, going to do this, I mean, that's not illegal to think,
right?
Now, is it? So that was just something that really blew my mind, and I've had a few moments like that while working. So I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's always the, we talk a lot about this on our Path to Libertarianism program on wearelibertarians.com, and it's something that, you know, Walter Block has talked a lot about in Defending the Undefendable. They don't take rights away from who's like a squeaky clean image in today's society. They don't take away rights from Taylor Swift.
Right. I was just about to say her.
You know, like, I'm trying to think of a squeaky clean person. She's kind of the squeaky cleaniest. You know, the upstanding rich girl who's made it, you know, on her talent and, you know, is in the public eye and mostly beloved. you know, everybody likes a little T-Swift every now and then, you know, otherwise you're just a liar. But they don't start with Taylor Swift. They start with the child molester. They start with the rapist. They start with the prostitute. They start with the people who are outcasts of society, and they start, and that's kind of what The House I Live In talks about, is they erode the rights of drug addicts because the public wants you to. They want you to erode the rights of the drug addict because they're the ills, they're causing all the ills of society. And so, you know, Brett has a good point in that To Catch a Predator, because while it feels really icky to make that argument that, well, they're just thinking, they're not acting, what other thought crimes might there be? And I know now we're sort of defending child molesters. Thanks, Chloe. But
defending them, but you know.
But you're saying,
well, there's a difference in defending child molesters and defending people who might be attracted to children. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you can't, I guess, really help what your brain is attracted to, but the action of actually harming a child is the act that's egregious, not
absolutely
the act of thinking about it, I guess.
Right. In any crime, you may have the impulse to murder, but it's the lack of self-control that makes you the criminal.
Right.
So it's really kind of, you know, that's the distinction for any crime, is are you taking away the rights of another person? And so what it boils down to in anything within libertarianism, and this is, I think, what you're trying to get at, Chloe, is that emotionally, these things are wrong. Like, it's wrong to kill people. So we should just do everything we can to pass a law to make sure that somebody doesn't get killed. And eventually that creeps into someone thinking about murdering their boss, and you get into the Minority Report once technology gets to a certain point. And you even have that. Like, if you see the show Jim Caviezel and the little nerdy guy, and there's the supercomputer that watches all of society, Person of Interest on mm-hmm. CBS. That's based on all the stuff that Edward Snowden released, and all that stuff actually exists. All these computer crime nets, essentially, where it is predicting behavior out of human beings. Because as much as we all like to think that we're the unique little snowflakes, just like your mommy told you, there are certain patterns. Human beings follow certain patterns, and you can predict criminal behavior, and so. At what point does technology get to the point where it is following you and I at every turn, and it predicts that, well, based on these factors, these financial factors, based on this emotional temperament, and these words said as dictated by the Siri-like device, we believe he's going to do this. So we got to go pick him up. That is a very real ethical concern that I think we'll face in our lifetimes.
Well, now you're talking Minority Report, a great movie that really puts that on display, and you know it really makes you think.
And so, yeah, so libertarians get to the point that say you can't prevent certain actions. You can't, as we talked about on the abortion episode, I'm a firm believer that you can't pass a law to change someone's heart. You have to persuade, and that is what the Advocates is all about, is persuading people to be more libertarian. That's what we do here. We can't force you to do anything. All we can do is persuade you to live a more libertarian life. And, you know, with what it comes down to is you may say and do and you may say and think whatever you'd like as long as your actions do not infringe upon my rights. And that is what the government, if the government is to exist, it should exist just to mete out punishment when you take away my rights, essentially.
Well, it goes back to the phrase, no victim, no crime.
Right. And
if there's not an actual victim who's been harmed in one way or another, whether it's financial or physical or whatever the case may be, then there is no crime. It's that simple.
So, Chloe.
So, Chris.
Now, your cousin, the heroin addict, you look at it from an emotional place, but let's look at it from what we just discussed. Why do you feel that in the case of your cousin, and we can use a different example if it's less emotionally charged for you, why do you feel that the government and convicting her of crimes is the best way to treat her condition?
Well, and let me preface it by saying this. I've not seen her in probably 5 years.
Let's not get into specifics. Let's say a general right, drug addict.
A general drug addict. Okay.
Let's not make it about your cousin
right.
or whatever.
Well, and okay, so Roger just mentioned no victim, no crime. But I think that in a lot of cases, and I mean, this is very, you know, a what if type of situation. But if this person is, for example, having babies that are born addicted to drugs or are, you know, stealing from family members, you know, jewelry, possessions, whatever that may be, in order to buy drugs, I mean, then there are some clear victims here. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? So I feel like, okay, yes, if that person is, you know, really at that point where there are victims because of their drug use, then by all means, yeah, maybe they should be punished. But if you're, you know, just at a party and, I don't know, doing ecstasy or whatever it is these kids do nowadays, and you're not hurting anyone physically or, you know, financially or whatever, then truly there is no crime, in my opinion.
Okay. Because in my opinion, the best way to help someone is to get them treatment.
Absolutely.
And not to warehouse them and make them better drug addicts. Because what we tend to do is lock a drug addict up where they can get more drugs and they spend time with better criminals who teach them how to be better criminals. And then they get out with this record and they can't get a job. And so they go back to selling drugs, using drugs. And it's just, it basically creates a cycle that feeds the leech system that is our criminal justice system, where you've got private prisons like we talked about in episode 91. If you've never gone back and listened to episode 91, Rachel's story, you have to go back and listen to it. I mean, it is, and you especially, that's part of your homework too.
Okay.
Is to go back
be prepared because that is a difficult episode to listen to. I had a really hard time listening to it.
Absolutely.
It is the story of my friend Woody and his daughter Rachel, who was essentially killed in prison by neglect by the prison doctors, and she was facing 16 years for selling like 2 or 3 or 4 pills. We talked about it in the episode, the specifics.
Wow.
We'll have to have Woody back on to kind of talk about where they're at, but things are progressing well. And several people have admitted mistakes in her situation. But there's a person who the drug war killed her. Like she's the face of what happens to people at the hands of this government. And you got to go back and listen to episode 91, share it, tell people about it, please. It's a powerful episode. It's very difficult to listen to at times, but necessary because we need to be faced with the evil within our own system. You know, there were 100 people that came into contact with this girl who was very clearly dying over the course of a couple months, and nobody did shit for her. It was one man out of probably 100 people who finally had the courage to call and say, "Hey, your daughter's here. She's dying. You might want to do something." So check that episode out and watch The House I Live In. Not only you, Chloe, but anybody who is... it's not just about the drug war. It's, you know, it's just like with what Brett said to you about To Catch a Predator. It wasn't specifically like the kid touchers, which are my personal hot button issue. I don't want anybody to get the impression that we are in any way like sticking up for them at all. Because if you've ever committed domestic or sexual violence, I will personally punch you right in the face. But you in that moment started to think about government in a different way.
I did, right.
And that's why it was powerful. I mean, what was the light bulb that went off for you?
I think it was just realizing that, whoa, these people are being arrested because they were thinking. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, they were thinking that they were talking to someone that was, you know, 12, 13 years old. But essentially, they were talking to an adult that was of, you know, legal age.
Right.
And that just, it just blew my mind that they were being arrested like that, you know?
Yeah, there's been a lot of controversy around that show in particular, like the public shaming of people who have who've not been convicted of anything. They're just suspected.
Well, now I have no issue with public shaming. public shaming someone who is, I mean, that's one of your only tools if we live in a true libertarian society, because you can't use force against people. You can't just lock people up. You have to shun that person. You have to step away from that person and make it public. I have no issue with the public shaming of that. What I have an issue with is arresting someone who has not committed a crime.
Right.
Let's shift gears, and instead of talking about the Democratic debate, I want to talk about the drone program first. This is just kind of just developing on The Intercept, and I'm just going to read straight from Greg's notes, so that way we're all kind of prepared. These are, as far as I know, in Greg's own words. So this is kind of the background of this development that Edward Snowden called one of the most significant developments in the war against the surveillance state. Every president since Gerald Ford has upheld an executive order banning assassinations by U.S. personnel. Congress has avoided legislating the issue or even defining the word assassination. This has allowed proponents of the drone wars to rebrand assassinations with more palatable characterizations, such as the term du jour, targeted killings. Could you keep the drinking of your wine down a little bit over there? You're slurping into the microphone.
Well, I'm sorry.
So if you want to see a photo of Chloe drinking her wine out of a sippy straw, go to our Instagram, We Are Libertarians. President Obama authorized only when an imminent threat is present and there is near certainty that the intended target will be eliminated. Those terms, however, appear to have been bluntly redefined to bear almost no resemblance to their commonly understood meanings. One top secret document shows how the terror watch list appears in the terminals of personnel conducting drone operations, linking unique codes associated with cell phone SIM cards and handsets to specific individuals in order to geolocate them. In the case of a British citizen, Bilal El Berjawi, who was stripped of his citizenship before killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2012, British and American intelligence had Berjawi under surveillance for several years as he traveled back and forth between the UK and East Africa, yet did not capture him. Instead, the US hunted him down and killed him in Somalia. In December 2009, the administration signed off on its first covert airstrike in Yemen, a cruise missile attack that killed more than 40 people, most of them women and children. Which leads us to Operation Haymaker. From 2011 to 2013, the most elite forces in the U.S. military, supported by the CIA and other elements of the intelligence community, set out to destroy the Taliban and al-Qaeda forces that remained hidden among the soaring peaks and plunging valleys of the Hindu Kush, along Afghanistan's northeastern border with Pakistan. Dubbed Operation Haymaker, the campaign has been described as a potential model for the future of American warfare. Special operations units partnered with embedded intelligence elements running a network of informants, pinpointing members of violent organizations, then drawing up plans to eliminate those targets from the battlefield by capturing or killing them. Over the course of 5 months, stretching through the summer of 2012, Haymaker operations included 27 raids and 27 airstrikes. The raids resulted in the capture of 61 people, 13 of them jackpots, the actual target of the mission. A total of 2 people were reportedly killed in these ground operations. In the airstrikes, meanwhile, a total of 155 people were killed and labeled as enemies killed in action, according to a table presented in the documents. Just 19 of the 155 people were killed were actual jackpots. Again, the people that were initially targeted. So, just to recap that, over this course, there were 27 raids and 27 airstrikes. The raids, boots on the ground, resulted in the capture of 61 people, 13 of them jackpots, 2 of them killed. Okay? In the airstrikes, the bombings from drones, a total of 155 people were killed, 19 were jackpots. So everybody was killed, including innocent people, in the airstrikes. And in the raids, we had a lot of people captured, useful for finding more information, and 2 people were killed. The military's own analysis demonstrates that the Haymaker campaign was in many respects a failure. The vast majority of those killed in airstrikes were not the direct targets, nor did the campaign succeed in significantly degrading Al-Qaeda's operation in the region. The document showed that during a five-month stretch of the campaign, nearly 9 out of 10 people who died in the airstrikes were not the Americans' direct target. A study conducted by a U.S. military advisor has found that drone strikes in Afghanistan during a year of the protracted conflict caused 10 times more civilian casualties than strikes by manned fighter aircraft.
And people wonder why I say that American policy has created more terrorists than Osama bin Laden ever did.
Right. So let me repeat that. A study conducted by a U.S. military advisor has found that drone strikes in Afghanistan during a year of the protracted conflict caused 10 times more civilian casualties than strikes by manned fighter aircraft. So you're better off sending boots on the ground, and when that is not an option, send in fighter aircrafts and then drones, but drones are going to cause 10 times more civilian casualties.
We're better off just staying the hell out of there, frankly.
One final note, Gilgamesh. The hunting and killing operations relied on advanced technology to zero in on targets, including cell phone geolocation system known as Gilgamesh. As The Intercept reported in 2014, the Gilgamesh system employs a simulated cell phone tower to identify and locate targeted Sims. And I think he ran out of space there or something, because he just kind of stops. But clearly, our drone program... So, Roger, let me ask this, okay? We're at war with radical Muslim elements that want to kill you and I. And in war, people, if you go to war, people are going to die, and that includes civilian casualties. So if, you know, and 155 people is a relatively low number compared to something like carpet bombing in Dresden.
Well, unless you're one of the family members or loved ones of one of those 155 people.
Well, see, now you're starting to erode my argument here. And I'm a conservative. I'm Sean Hannity. I don't like when you do that. But we're at war with these people. These people want to kill our people. And what are you going to do? You have to protect the United States. You have to keep us safe. And this is the best way. I mean, yes, 155 people died, but 19 of the bad guys died. And so it's much, much better for Americans, for you and I, if those 19 die. And then we just have a little collateral damage. No?
No, not at all. Like I said earlier, American policy, these bombings, these killings of innocent civilian people create more terrorists. Think about it this way. If China were drone bombing the United States and they were trying to get some of our bad guys, but then, you know, 9 times out of 10, they were actually killing civilians. What do you think the families of those civilians would do? They would want to kill Chinese. That's what we're causing in these countries. We are causing people who want to kill us. Yeah, we've killed a lot of terrorists. We've probably stopped some terrorism, but we've also created an atmosphere that breeds more terrorists and, by default, more terrorism.
Okay. Chloe, you're a Republican. You love to kill brown people, right?
I wouldn't classify myself as a Republican. Okay. I voted for Republicans. I voted for Democrats. I mean, I'm only 23, so I've not been able to vote for a Libertarian yet. So okay. Back right. off. Yeah. I don't know. I struggle with this as well. Again, I'm 23 years old. 9/11 happened when I was 9 years old. So I feel, I was a youngin.
I'm old.
Yeah, you are old. So I feel like anything that has to do with the Middle East is always way over my head because I've just always grown up with it, never really understanding. But I wrote an article for The Liberator Online, which if you don't subscribe to it, is the Advocate's newsletter that comes out every Thursday. You can do that on our website. But it was about the airstrikes that happened in Afghanistan. I believe it was last week at the Doctors Without Borders Hospital. And that was really the first thing that I've thoroughly researched as a journalist and, you know, compiled a lot of information on. And it's just awful. You know, it just really... makes me, I don't want to say it makes me embarrassed to be an American, but it just makes me embarrassed because I think that that's a sucky way to go about doing things.
Well, and you talk about the hospital bombing. That is perhaps the most egregious thing that our government has ever done. probably on up there with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. Because
can you recap that for our listeners before you jump into an opinion? What exactly happened?
Well, so there was a hospital that we knew the geolocation of that hospital. We knew that it was a hospital. Doctors Without Borders was very clear with American forces, UK forces, everyone else that yes, this is a hospital, and it was a protected environment. And yet, I guess by some sort of mistake, of course nobody's saying it was a mistake, we bombed right. this hospital, killed dozens of people in a hospital. You do not bomb a hospital in war, especially one that is being run by a nonpartisan group like that. I mean, you wouldn't do it, period. You don't ever bomb a friggin' hospital.
Yeah, but, I mean, medics and clergy and journalists are always, right. I mean, in the history of war have always had, special protections, with the exception of, I guess, ISIS. They don't give you a
pass.
They
don't care.
But the issue here was that we knew that this was a hospital, but we bombed it anyway. The Doctors Without Borders people that were in the hospital were calling, their American contacts saying, look, we're being bombed. Nobody stopped it. It went on for over an hour.
Mm-hmm.
This is just egregious.
Well, it's ridiculous to begin with. And then I believe the leadership of Doctors Without Borders basically said to the U.S., hey, we want a full, transparent investigation done about this. And I can't remember what the general's name is, but I found a news piece from either NBC or CBS that basically said, well, we'll investigate, maybe, but we're not really sure, so...
Right. So now, in the interim, we have a hospital that was being run very well, that was taking care of not only war casualties, but also civilians as well, that is now closed and will not be opened again until the U.S. can give assurances that we won't bomb it again. And can the U.S. do that? No. The U.S. is refusing to give assurances that they won't bomb another hospital. This is a war crime, plain and simple.
Right.
So that is the government that you are paying taxes to and that you were supporting. And when you vote for Republicans or Democrats, that is the government that you are getting, because this was started under George Bush, and Barack Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, has continued and escalated and shifted us in this direction. I mean, just the idea that, a military study says that you're going to get 10 times more civilian casualties by drone strikes than manned fighter aircraft just tells me it's like this, something's got to be done. And, and also, it is interesting to know, just one little footnote, Rand Paul is a Hospitals Without Borders doctor, and the Nobel Peace Prize winning president bombed his one of his organizations. So that is the government that you are supporting, and you need to wake up and you need to pay attention to what your government is doing, and share this podcast, because I just think we lack empathy.
Absolutely.
And it's easy to say, well, those people, if they're around these 19 jackpots, those 155 people, they must have known, they're guilty by association. Apply that same principle to our government doing that to you. Chloe's cousin is not Chloe. And, Tsarnaev's wife here in Boston, she didn't know what her husband was plotting. She didn't know that he was, there is some like, oh, well, hey, what are all these bombs doing in the living room? But, it's never been proven that she has been a part of the Boston bombing plot. So if it can't be proven, should she just be put in jail as a co-conspirator without any evidence? Just because she might have known something? I don't know. That's the government that we're creating, and we're creating it because we feel like something should be done, as opposed to feeling like, what is it like to be the loved one of these 155 people killed in action? And I think if we had empathy for the people that we're supposed to hate, or at least took the second to think about what it would be like in the shoes of an innocent in that area, we might elect different leaders.
Well, I'm not a very empathetic person. That's not the way that I work. I'm I'm your classic objectivist. I'm concerned about me, you know, me and mine. And that's what really pisses me off about this, because if this can happen to somebody over there, then it can certainly happen here. I mean, Obama has indiscriminately killed American citizens with drone strikes. American citizens. If that doesn't make you wake up, I don't know what will.
Yeah, exactly. Final thoughts on drone strikes, Chloe? Anything?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about our leadership. Let's talk about the Democratic debate. This is, you know, this
I don't care about her damn emails either.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, this is the first Democratic debates since 2008. I mean, that's a long time. But, so we saw Hillary versus Bernie Sanders versus a few other guys that we'll review. This is an interesting quote from Politico. The CNN debate was like Jeb Bush. CNN debate was like Jeb Bush swooping in and dominating a debate against Jim Gilmore, George Pataki, and Lindsey Graham, and everyone concluding he's a marvelous performer, and it's time for the bedwetters to stop worrying about his candidacy. That's a very accurate quote, because I have always thought, you know, Bernie Sanders, her great competition, really is just kind of a lightweight. He's really he's a footnote, a joke, an afterthought.
See, several episodes ago on the Lava Flow, right after Bernie first jumped into the race officially, I made the bold claim that Bernie Sanders will take the Democratic nomination. And I still believe that today, even stronger today. Hillary Clinton will never get that nomination. There are too many people, including a lot of Democrats, who cannot stand that woman because of the lies, the just all of the bullshit surrounding her. Not because she's a Clinton, but just because of her personally, Benghazi and the lies, the emails, everything. But Bernie Sanders comes off as this, you know, likable, congenial guy. He's Uncle Bernie. And yes, his policies are way the hell out there. But there are a large number of people out there who want free shit. They want to steal shit from me for themselves. And there are a lot of people who love that. And then you have people who were kind of on the fence who think that Bernie's a great guy. So why not vote for him? I mean, even Penn Jillette said that Bernie Sanders, that he liked Bernie Sanders, not his policies or anything. And he certainly probably won't vote for him. But that's a prominent libertarian saying that he likes Bernie Sanders.
Well, but again, I've said it time and time again, Bernie Sanders is a guy that flashes authenticity. And that's one of, I think that was Pendula, that's why he said it, is that he's an authentic person, that he believes what he says. But right. If you look at his track record, that's all bullshit. And Hillary Clinton totally left him exposed on some of the gun debate stuff. Bernie Sanders has sort of the Rand Paul, Ron Paul problem of unlikability, where there is, he's sort of your crazy, cranky old grandfather who doesn't necessarily lighten up. I mean, Ron Paul is beloved because of his beliefs, but it's not like you want to have a beer with Ron Paul. You know, at least Hillary Clinton has some personality.
Yeah, but Bernie, almost every poll after the debate showed Bernie Sanders winning handily over Hillary Clinton. Like the Google survey, 43.7% said that Sanders was in the lead after this debate, 15 points ahead of Clinton. So all of these polls show that Bernie won that debate, yet all of the news media is touting Hillary won. And obviously there's, you know, a lot of history with Hillary in the media, and that goes pretty far back. And the media is going to pick their, you know, who they want to win. But it seems like the people aren't really going to stand for it this time. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, if it had been Ron Paul versus Mitt Romney in 2012, you would have had the same thing happening. You know, the grassroots are behind Bernie Sanders. Every young person that I know that isn't a libertarian or some diehard getting a paycheck from the GOP type, they're all supporting Bernie Sanders. I mean, what's your Facebook like in terms of Bernie Sanders?
Oh, I have to unfollow a lot of people because I'm just so tired of it. But I have a lot of friends that really like Bernie Sanders. And then, of course, I still have a lot of strong ties to the GOP. So I have a lot of friends that are really, you know, all over the place on the opposite side.
Right.
So I haven't unfriended anybody who likes Bernie yet because I just loved, you know, dragging it on with them. I mean, these people, including Bernie, have no concept of basic economics.
No.
And if you just slap them in the face with a little bit of economics, they probably won't change their mind. But that, you know, that casual lurker who's just surfing through Facebook, you know, it might actually make some differences there. So I keep going after these people. I saw the funniest thing today. Somebody has actually started a GoFundMe account for like $4,000. They're trying to raise $4,000 to send Bernie Sanders to an economics course.
I was at a bar in Indy on Saturday night, and my good friend Tyler had found a couple of young co-eds that he was trying to smooth talk, and I wanted to troll Tyler, so I went up to talk to the co-eds too, because I'm much more handsome and much more charming than Tyler Weiss. Is I know he listens, so I'm trolling him now. And so I started talking to them, and they're like, "Who are you? You're old." I'm like, "I am the mayor of Broad Ripple." They're like, "You're not the mayor of Broad Ripple." I'm like, "I've won 17 elections." "How old are you? Like 50? Oh. And I was like, "Oh no, I'm 32. "Oh, okay. Well, you look pretty good for 32 then." I'm like, "Thanks." "What party are you with?" I said, "I'm not with a party. I'm a guy like Bernie Sanders. Oh my God, I love Bernie Sanders. He's totally going to change it." That is the same horseshit.
And just
that I heard about Barack Obama.
Yep.
Just out of the blue, if I see one more person post this shit that, you know, Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist and Nazis were democratic socialists, I'm going to reach through my fucking computer and kill somebody. Nazis were national socialists. That just drives me crazy.
Right.
Trying to associate, I mean, not that I'm a Bernie Sanders fan, and I'm certainly not trying to defend him, but trying to say that he's anything like the Nazis is, oh, come on. Give me a break, people.
I saw somebody, you know, there was a signing of Hitler signing some gun control legislation and Barack Obama signing some executive order, and like the meme was basically saying that he's worse than Hitler. And it's like, come on. It's unless you're writing flowery quotes over the top of Adolf Hitler, I don't want to see him on my timeline.
Right.
So yeah, that's I think the appeal of Bernie Sanders. I think for disaffected youth, there isn't a Ron Paul candidate and there isn't a Barack Obama candidate, because they're not going to get behind Hillary Clinton. They're not going to get behind Rand. They're certainly not going to get behind Jeb Bush or Donald Trump. So it's sort of the cool thing for young people to get behind Bernie Sanders, and that's what you're seeing. You know, and then obviously the longtime Democratic socialists who have been in the closet are finally able to come out. This is their coming out party. But right. I have long said that, you know, if you study anything about Eugene Debs 100 years ago, and you look at today's Democratic Party, a lot of what Eugene Debs talked about, he was the Socialist Party candidate for many years until he was put into jail by Woodrow Wilson for speaking out against World War I. There's going to be a lot of appeal for a Eugene Debs. And so it doesn't surprise me that a Bernie Sanders starts to catch on. Go to Wikipedia, look up Eugene Debs, D-E-B-S, and from Terre Haute, Indiana, as a matter of fact. And if you study this man and what he believed, you start to see that our country is headed for old school progressivism, typified by what Bernie Sanders says, and which is an all powerful state that is, you know, altruistic and meant to help everyone, and then libertarianism as defined by Ron Paul, sort of this minarchism direction. And I've long said that that's kind of where we're headed, and this doesn't surprise me in the least bit that a Bernie Sanders starts to catch on, because, you know, people run to the extremes. The more extreme we can head, the better it sounds like it'll be fit.
Well, but I don't think libertarianism is extreme at all. I mean, don't hit me and don't take my stuff. I mean, we learned that as kindergartners. There's nothing extreme about libertarianism.
The fact is that you and I both know that you do an OPH booth at, you know, some fair, and you start talking about libertarianism, people start to look at you like you're crazy because you don't want any government.
Right. That's why you don't use the term libertarian. I almost never use that term anymore, because it's almost like anarchist. It's really taken this negative tone, and I almost never use it anymore.
Yeah. So Hillary Clinton was deemed the front runner. She looked like the grown up in the room, according to the media. And excuse me. Oh, my. I've been up since 4:30 a.m. I'm tired. I've been going. It's 8:40 as we're recording this, and I have not sat down and just relaxed all day. I'm dying. Now, see what I do for the listeners. I give and I give and I give.
Yes, you do.
We didn't let you talk about Bernie Sanders. You're the young person in the room. Roger's old as fuck, and I'm just a little old.
I'm not even 40 yet. Give me a break.
I mean, I'll say this. I am not impressed by the promise of, oh, you get free this, and you get free this, and you get free that, because I heard that in 2008. I was too young to vote, but I had friends that were, you know, 2 years older than me in 2008, and they voted for Barack Obama because, you know, I want free this, and I want free healthcare and all of this stuff, and, you know, I've not gotten any free stuff from Barack Obama that I can think of. You know what I mean?
I got a 7% pay cut.
Yeah,
my insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I already pay.
Oh, don't
a crap
even talk
ton
to me about
taxes.
Insurance. When I switched jobs a couple of months ago, my insurance doubled. It went from about $500 a month to about $1,000 a month because the plans that I had on my old company had some issues because it was kind of pre-Obamacare, so it had some other weird stuff in it, whereas the one that I went to was just outrageous. I mean, literally went from $500 to $1,000 a month.
That's amazing.
I believe it. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, if Bernie Sanders gets elected, I'm not going to see any of that free tuition because I just graduated from college, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I'm not impressed. I have friends that are stupid and that think that this is going to work out and that they're not going to have to pay, you know, for a single cent for any of this, you know, free stuff that he's promising. But I don't know. I'm just not impressed. And I'm certainly not impressed with Hillary Clinton. I thought that as far as these debates go, whether that be on the Republican or the Democratic side, it really is all about who is the best persuader and who's the best, you know, storyteller, who's the best person that can, you know, tug on your heartstrings. I thought, at least to me, it seemed like Hillary was way too rehearsed, that she'd been practicing for this debate for too long, which, you know, I think worked in her favor for people that are, you know, very low information, not very informed.
She looks like she's in charge.
Oh yeah. I mean, she's able to look like she's in charge, and, you know, I don't want to just say this because she's a woman. I don't want, you know, listeners to think that, you know, I'm, you know, sexist at all. But I could tell she had some Botox done to make herself look younger.
Catty.
Yeah, little catty rare. But I don't know. I just think she's trying too hard. You know, I think a lot of people are trying too hard, but I especially think she's trying too hard. But I mean, you know, she really wants it. Who wouldn't go to extreme lengths to get what they want?
Well, and you have to understand the reason she looks like she's been in charge or she is in charge is because she was president for 8 years. I mean,
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You can say Bill Clinton was president all you want, but you know who wore the pants in that family.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the email thing, a couple congressmen are starting to come out and say, you know, yeah, she was targeted. I'm so sorry.
Do you need me to take this over? Are you okay?
Go ahead.
Yeah, where's Greg when we need him?
I know. Right? Go ahead.
So a couple congressmen said that she was targeted in the Benghazi stuff. The email thing is just another, you know, Whitewater scandal that they're trying to bring the man down. Do you know, Bernie Sanders kind of scored points by saying, we're all tired of hearing about your damn emails. Are you tired of hearing about her damn emails, Chloe?
I honestly am not. I mean, I'm tired of hearing about it because I feel like nothing has been resolved from this whole scandal. But at the same time, I feel like it, like day one, if you work for the government, my boyfriend Pedro works for a congressman. I have a lot of friends that work in Indiana in government. From day one, you do not send out any information from a personal server. That's like day one intern stuff. And to me, it's like, how stupid do you have to be to not hold yourself to the same standards that you have everybody else hold themselves to? I just think it was very stupid from her part. I'm glad that she admitted it during the debate. But, you know, I would just like to hear more about the results of this investigation. And I'm just tired of hearing that, oh, well, we're investigating it now and there's no new information. That's what kind of bugs me.
nothing's ever going to come of it. It'll never happen long as we live. And
no.
And I'm with you. I mean, I'm only tired of hearing it because nothing has been done. Mm-hmm. You know, if I hear one more, you know, oh, she did all this. Yes, she did. But they're not going to do anything about it. So get over it.
Right.
What can we do? Let's move on. You know, let's find, you know, I mean, the woman has done such egregious things in her past. I mean, Benghazi is just a huge one. You know, these emails, that's a minor issue. I mean, frankly, some of the information that got out is information that we needed to have anyway.
Right.
You know, I'm not a big fan of, you know, government secrets and shit. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Edward Snowden. The guy's a fucking hero as far as I'm concerned. And I think we need more people who use a personal server so that shit, you know, is out there. But something should be done about this. If Edward Snowden had done what she did, you know, he'd be in jail right now.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary scored a couple blows against Bernie Sanders that I think really kind of left him reeling. I saw today that he's changing some of his campaign strategies, start doing smaller events. And anytime you hear Bernie Sanders in response is doing things differently in the campaign, like, that's never a good sign for a candidate when they start to do that. But Hillary is legitimately to the left of Bernie Sanders on guns, and she dealt him a body blow, I think.
Well, Bernie Sanders comes from Vermont, which has some of the most lax gun laws in the country. I mean, they have fully constitutional carry, meaning you can carry anywhere you want to as long as you're over the age of 18 without any kind of government permit, and you can even carry concealed without a government permit. I mean, that's even better gun laws than New Hampshire has. So, I mean, coming from there, you know, he also still has to kind of protect himself, because if he doesn't win this presidency, he's still going to be running for office in Vermont. So he needs to protect that position. So I think that that's where a lot of that comes from.
Yeah, it's a compromise. There were several others on the stage. We'll just kind of touch on these guys. Martin O'Malley, the only lifelong Democrat in the field,
mm-hmm.
two-term governor, notched several progressive achievements, including passing legislation legalizing same-sex marriage and outlawing the death penalty in Maryland. And he only got crappy poll numbers for it. In Greg's opinion, he would look like he was running for the vice president. He is really not able. He hasn't gained any traction, and he's largely forgotten. It was a chance for him to make a name for himself, and you really have not heard a lot about him in the past days. And he didn't position himself as the anti-Clinton, sort of the other grown-up on the stage. And instead, he went after Sanders, recounting the story of a Colorado family whose child died in the Aurora massacre and went on to sue a man who sold 4,000 rounds of ammunition to the killer and beat up on Bernie Sanders for protecting gun makers and ammunition makers. Which, curious, okay. Any thoughts on Martin's O'Malley's?
Who?
Okay.
I mean, seriously, I mean, he has no chance in hell. I mean, he might as well just hang it up now.
He was the guy. I mean, the South Carolina article is coming. Like, you got to watch this guy. You got to watch it. And he's kind of nowhere. Guy that I think, I'm interested to go back and watch his performance. Jim Webb is an interesting guy to me. I don't know.
Excuse me.
I don't know that he has. He's sort of like, you know how there are guys who are just too liberal to make it through the primaries in the Republican Party. Webb is a little too conservative probably to make it through the Democratic Party. He's the former Reagan Secretary of the Navy, very pragmatic guy, pragmatic opposition to the Bush-era foreign policy. More than the populist fever that has swept America in the recent years. During the debate, he was more often heard demanding airtime than he was seen on camera. When he was, his answers tended to be discursive, with essentially no big moments like Sanders' damn emails line or effective policy shots like Clinton's jabs at the gun record. That might grab the attention of the media or the voters. His finest moment was the respectful exchange with Sanders, in which Webb gracefully declined to take shots at Sanders' status as a conscientious objector during Vietnam, and Sanders praised Webb's service and key role in passing a post-9/11 GI Bill. I believe Jim Webb was in Vietnam. Both men came off as thoughtful and humane, and Webb got a competitor to talk about his biggest political achievement, but in a debate that was generally civil and substantive, it wasn't enough. Webb talked about the end of affirmative action on poor whites, the need to respect gun owner rights, and the danger from threats Democrats don't generally acknowledge, like China. Webb told Sanders that Congress would be unlikely to vote to pay for all of his expensive proposed social programs. In general, he seemed like an old-line Southern Democrat, said Mr. Garrity.
And that's Webb's big attraction. But I must say that I think he's probably the only person who has ever been in a presidential debate, both Republican or Democrat, who essentially stood up there and said that he killed a guy. I mean, he told this story of being in Vietnam and where the person the enemy he most respected or something in Vietnam was a guy that tried to kill him with a grenade, and Webb said, and he's no longer with us, or something along those lines. I mean, Webb just basically said in a Democratic presidential national debate that he killed a guy in war. That's never happened before. It was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I think, did Greg's notes say that he had no like big moments?
Yeah.
See, I disagree. I did watch like the first hour and a half in, and when they were talking about gun control, he was the one that basically called the other candidates out and said, wait a minute here. So you were all against guns for, you know, common folk, people like you and me, but you all have bodyguards, and said you pay someone to protect you with a weapon. And so I think his stance was very much against, you know, having more gun laws and things like that. But to me, it's like, you know, to the Bernie Sanders, to the O'Malley's, to the Clintons, that, you know, just think that, oh, well, you know, it's the gun that's the problem, but yet they're complete hypocrites because you have a bodyguard that's with you the majority of the time when you do events. I don't know. I thought it was pretty ballsy, but I don't really think, you know, younger people that are around my age realize the hypocrisy of all of that.
Yeah, and I don't think that he is, he's sort of known for being outspoken and aggressive and a great writer. He's mm-hmm. He's written several books, I think, including a history of West Point, I want to say, and maybe some military fiction as well. He also, I think he was in the Senate when he punched a guy. So he is very, people want to talk about Donald Trump's temperament issues. If Webb ever got any traction, his temperament would be a major problem for Jim Webb.
Well, I will say this about Webb. Out of the five, if I were forced to pull the lever for one of the five, Jim Webb would have to be the one I would pull the trigger for.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, Lincoln Chafee, former governor and Republican senator from Rhode Island. He has never won an election as a Democrat. Bernie Sanders is the other. He's always been an independent. Chafee was a Republican senator, then an independent governor, and then became a Democrat while in office, a prep school classmate of Jeb Bush at Andover. Chafee is a scion, Greg with his big words, of one of the Rhode Island's five families.
Actually, I think that's Wikipedia he pulled that from. But
whatever. Okay. All right. Let's see. This is kind of an interesting fact. His pedigree runs from his father, John, Rhode Island governor, secretary of the Navy, four-term senator, back to great-great-grandfather, who was the state's governor, and a great-great-uncle, who was a U.S. senator, all the way to an ancestor whose arrival in New England in 1637 almost coincided with the arrival of Jeb Bush's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Upon graduating from Brown, where he majored in classics, Chafee, like a Huck Finn shucking off an Ivy League patina, lit out for the territories, for Montana, to take up blacksmithing, where he... Oh, could there be anything more douchey than that? Which he practiced for 7 years, often at harness racing tracks from Canada to Florida. Chafee wrote a book about how broken Congress is and could gain some traction there, but I just feel like a guy who's been a Republican at a certain point, they'll forgive Bernie Sanders because he's been an independent in Vermont where Democrats are not going to win. Chafee has flip-flopped, and he just kind of seems like an out-of-touch New England liberal that people are just not going to get behind.
Well, at this point, it's going to be either Hillary or Bernie, unless somebody jumps in, like an Al Gore or
Joe Biden.
Or Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden has came out, he will not run, but he could change his mind. He did promise his dead son that he would run for president. So, I mean, it's very possible that that may tug at his heartstrings and change his mind. So, you know, unless something like that happens to shake things up, it's going to be Hillary or Bernie. It's that simple. And I still stand by what I said months ago, that it's going to be Bernie.
Okay, so over the last quarter, of the $136.9 million donated so far to support Democratic candidates, 12.7% has been raised by super PACs and other independent groups, and almost all of that has gone to Hillary Clinton. So here's sort of all you need to know. Hillary Clinton got twice the amount of money of Bernie Sanders, who's in second, at $92 million raised on her behalf. No, this is to date. And then Bernie Sanders, $41 million. Martin O'Malley has raised $2.3 million. Larry Lessig, is that the software guy? Larry Lessig? I forget. Not important. $1 million. Lincoln Chafee, $392,000. And Jim Webb has raised and reported zero. I'm sure he's raised money now, but...
Well, and you'll see Bernie Sanders' numbers change a lot next quarter because of his strong showing in this debate, I believe. I think that this is really going to draw a lot of money to him because he showed himself not to be that wacky, crazy kind of, you know, Uncle Bernie that a lot of people see him as, that they love that. But he also showed himself as, you know, being kind of a, you know, somebody who could do the job. And that's really important.
Yeah. I'd ask you if you have thoughts on Lincoln Chafee, but who cares, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
All right. Overall predictions, we hear Roger saying that Bernie will be the nominee for the Democrats. What do you say, Chloe? Who do you think is going to pull
out? Again, I've been telling my friends that know that I've worked in politics before and that I do things like this are always asking me, well, who do you think? Who do you think? And it's like, people. The polls do not matter right now because we're so far out. But I really think that Bernie could come out on top. Now, I mean, I think things could change, but I kind of would like to see Bernie come out on top because I really don't like Hillary Clinton. But that's just me.
I don't feel that way. I think Bernie Sanders is probably not a very good politician and probably not very shrewd and is not going to raise as much money as the Clintons. And the Clintons are going to dig up as much as they can. I mean, the Clintons are, I mean, you being from Arkansas know this, Roger. I mean, they're the ones who started the birther stuff with Barack Obama.
Right.
That machine, man, they'll put somebody against the wall. And I don't think that Bernie Sanders can withstand that.
But I don't know that Bernie Sanders has anything for them to bring up, though. I mean, he's been doing this for so long that if somebody had something on him, it would have already been played, especially the last month or so as he's been gaining so much traction. I just don't believe for a second there's something out there. I think he's squeaky clean. But the best thing that could happen for the Republicans is for Hillary Clinton to win. Because if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, the Republicans will win in a landslide. No doubt about it.
And I don't know about Joe Biden. I think if Hillary had just fallen totally flat in that debate, according to the media, I think Joe Biden would be announcing next week. But... She's kind of the media darling, so now I don't know. I think he might not get in.
Well, and he has come out and said that he is not going to run. Generally, people don't make that strong of a statement, a statement, and then go back on it. So unless something major changes, I don't see Joe Biden jumping in at all.
Agreed.
Okay. Let's go to, I will speak on behalf at the end here, Chloe. You know, we like to give everyone the opportunity to share anything that they might have missed. I'm sure Roger will want to self-promote. So I will go first. I will read off some of Greg's, thingies. Stop me if you're taking any of these, but, the TPP, the, Trans-Pacific Partnership, not about Maya. Eliminates 18,000 existing tariffs between 12 countries that are otherwise hectoring each other with a punishing trade barrier. The biggest revelation from the leaked document that concerns Big Pharma. Their dream is pretty simple. They want to end generic drugs and the manner in which they distribute copies of the name brand products at a much lower prices. In foreign countries, generics are a key to life. They are the way that people benefit from improved medical technology without paying exorbitant U.S. prices. WikiLeaks got involved. and it released the full draft text of the IP sections. It turns out to be far more than the usual prattle, and expected stop to
standard SOP, standard operating procedures.
Okay. Oh yeah, to a few deep-pocketed industries. The IP sections of the TPP attempt to impose by force of blackmail the worst of American law as it applies to copyright, patent, and trademark, and do so in industries where there are otherwise some freedom left in the system. Turkey, an act of terrorism that saw 128 people killed at a political rally in Ankara this weekend, traces back at least somewhat to the government missteps in feeding Syrian violence. Violence that appears to now have migrated home. The attack by two suicide bombers whose victims had gathered in support of the opposition party HDP, or People's Democratic Party, has sent Turkey into uncharted territory. Finally, in Afghanistan, the Kunduz attack underscored an ugly reality. After nearly a decade and a half of war, more than 2,300 American lives lost and an estimated 26,000 Afghan civilian killed, the nature of combat in Afghanistan is entering new, potentially bloodier phase. Explosions, gunfire have been reported as Afghan government forces try to extend their control over the northern city of Kunduz, which was seized by Taliban fighters this week. On Thursday afternoon, the Taliban took back to the main square and raised their flag there once again. Government forces are now said to control much of the city, but remnants of the Taliban have been fighting back. Kunduz was the first major urban center to fall to the Taliban in 14 years. Street battles took place all day on Thursday as government forces pushed back the insurgents who seized the city on Monday, and many Taliban fighters have now retreated to the outskirts of Kunduz.
And now Obama's talking about sending troops back into Afghanistan.
And has extended the amount of people that are going to be staying there.
Right. That's exactly what we need, more war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that'll help it. Chloe, final thoughts, anything that you missed that you'd like to talk about?
I'm going to take a minute to ask everyone to check out the Advocates for Self-Government, our website. We're running a lot of book deals right now, so if you need to expand your Liberty Library, I would do that. We've got a lot of really good deals out there. Just want to ask people to like get informed and read things that aren't just on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. I like to read news stations or news channels rather from, you know, other countries. Get on the BBC, check out things, see what other people are saying about the U.S., how, you know, other countries perceive world news. I think that's a really awesome perspective. And a little self-promotion. feel kind of bad, but I fundraise year-round for the Children's Miracle Network. So if anyone would like to skip their Starbucks tomorrow and help me make miracles happen, especially for Riley's Children's Hospital here in Indianapolis. You can donate on my page. It's www.missamericaforkids.org/donate/Chloe Anagnos, Chloe Anagnos. That's all I've got to say.
Roger.
And I'll follow up with that if anybody wants more information on the Advocates, they can also listen to Brett Bittner. We talked about it quite a bit on my show. It's thelavaflow.com/15. We talked a lot about the Advocates, what they were doing, and kind of his role and what they're going to be doing in the future. It's really fascinating what these guys are going to be doing over the next year or so. So definitely check them out. It's a great organization. I've learned a lot from them. But as far as self-promotion, definitely check out the Lava Flow podcast. It's like I said, it's every 2 weeks. It's about half an hour a week, so it doesn't, you know, eat up a bunch of time with a bunch of stupid banter like other podcasts like this one. So if you've got it only half an hour every 2 weeks, listen to mine instead of this one, you know. But you can check it out at thelavaflow.com. And you know, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, you know, at the Lava Flow Pod. Just say hi.
What was that web address again?
The lava
Nobody flow. Cares.
TheLavaFlow.com.
All right. And as always, you can go and check out all the cool things at WeAreLibertarians.com. We don't really write much anymore, but...
That's going to change once I move into my apartment and get settled and actually start writing for you on Sundays like I said I would.
Good. I like to hear it. And if you're a writer and you want to submit things, then send it on to us. We'd like to have you. I just have to kick Joe in the pants and make him start actually... editing and posting things. Although somebody should kick me in the pants, so I could do it too, I guess. But we need some motivation here. We Are Libertarians. But hey, you had like 3 episodes last week. You're getting this episode tonight. You're getting another episode where I talked with Rob Kendall on his show, where I dish the dirt about my time as the Libertarian Party guy. And
there's 22 episodes of The Lava Flow Out.
And I mean, if you haven't killed yourself by the end of that, then there'll be another We Are Libertarians, I'm sure, next week. So, all right. Thank you for joining us here on the episode of the podcast. Man, I am tired. I am totally fried. I have run out of gas. You know, where Greg has failed me.
Yes.
Left me here alone with Roger and Chloe.
And I was looking forward to giving Greg a bunch of shit tonight. Maybe next time.
Do you think you can do the out? Do you think you know the ending? Can you do the
Sure. Closing? Yeah, I can do that. I've listened to every episode you've ever put out. So
all right.
I can do it.
All right. Let's see if you can do it. All right. So as always, we promise
to do better next time.
Nice. Good job.
All right.
You're the new Greg. Make a Hitler.
All right.
Make a Hitler meme.